Call the meeting to order. There's a number of bills today, and we're going to start with Representative Reiner. Bill, welcome to the committee, Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like to have someone move the bill for me, or what, you don't have a... maybe I should just start the testimony.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Representative Benson would like to move House File 3381. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And what we would be doing with it would be laying over for consideration in the omnibus bill, which we
Thank you very much, we will be building
at this point.
Thank you for having us today. Our bill is quite simple. If you haven't read it, you could glance at it and read it in about 5 seconds. The story is a bit more complicated, and the need will be apparent. As many of you know, in 1999, the legislature authorized a supportive housing and managed care pilot. Funds were appropriated in 2000 to work with families, and in 2001, the project was expanded to single adults. The pilot was a partnership between DHS and Ramsey and Blue Earth counties, supported by other organizations that you will hear about in a moment. The pilot's premise has been to support housing stability as the foundation for other health and quality of life improvements. Flexible planning focused on individual circumstances has resulted in out-of-the-box solutions. The success of the pilot led to last year's proposal for its expansion. The ambitious goal of ending long-term homelessness would be supported through this expansion and would fold the pilot project into the expanded program. The problem began with the vetoing of the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill last session. In the struggle to reach the lower target, the line item funding to continue the pilot was struck. Through intense last-minute negotiations, $2 million in one-time money was appropriated. This left the pilot $1 million short for the biennium. I'm sure that the irony of expanding the program while cutting the pilot is apparent. The intent of this appropriation is to fund the full program through the end of the biennium with the goal of integrating the expansion in the pilot and base funding in the coming biennium. I recently had the privilege of being toured through my own community by program staff. That experience has permanently altered how I see the streets, parks, and neighborhoods of my own town. The space along the river tucked behind an industrial site that provides a year-round tenting location for a homeless man. The small attic walk-up that was being negotiated at the very time of the tour to provide a home for someone on the street. A dilapidated trailer hidden in the corner of an old trailer court that provided interim shelter for someone. Sharing pizza on the floor of a newly occupied apartment, hearing the long struggle of a homeless woman who now had hope. I would like to introduce Jennifer Ho, the Executive Director of Hearts Connections, the nonprofit organization that has so successfully shepherded this program.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Ho. I'm the Executive Director of Hearts Connections. Hearts Connections was born out of a community planning process that began in 1996 to help people with long histories of homelessness who also struggle with mental illness, chemical dependency, and chronic health conditions. The result was a blueprint for the supportive housing and managed care pilot. Between 2000 and 2005, the legislature appropriated $10 million for the pilot. We've helped 144 single adults and 163 families in Blue Earth and Ramsey counties. We identified people with very long histories of homelessness, an average of 2 years for families and 7.5 years for single adults who were living outside or in cars or sleeping on sheltered floors. A participant is supported by a team to find housing and once housed to address other problems. These teams work one-on-one with someone wherever they are, in a shelter or outside, and ultimately in their own home. They help with things like getting appropriate medical and psychiatric care, signing up for benefits, getting groceries, reconnecting with family, and sometimes just being there to talk to. We proved that we can engage people in the pilot and help them get and keep housing. There's an amazing 85% annual retention rate. 100% of people who stayed with the pilot for at least 16 months got a home. 90% of current participants are in their own home today. When given real options, people do not choose to be homeless. A key premise of the pilot was that people with long histories of homelessness once housed would improve their health. An independent evaluator documented a 14% reduction in mental health symptoms, the equivalent of experiencing one less symptom a day, like hearing voices or racing thoughts. They also documented a reduction in drug and alcohol use. The pilot's success has been recognized by entities like the Gates Foundation and the Canadian government. Here at home, the success of the pilot informed the state's plan to end long-term homelessness. The pilot was viewed as so successful that the state funded its replication. We now operate in 26 counties and are helping over 600 households. In the 2007 legislative session, we talked about the pilot sunsetting in June 2007. We asked for $3 million for the long-term homeless supportive service fund base so that we could continue to support the 60 families and 90 single adults currently in the pilot. You said yes. The Senate said yes. Then the governor vetoed the Health and Human Services bill. And in the mad scramble of the last weekend of session, the funding to continue the pilot was cut, first to zero, then, thanks to the fight, many of you helped us fight, to $2 million in one-time money. You put $2 million in the first year of the biennium so that we wouldn't need to make cuts right away and told us to come back this year for a supplemental appropriation. No one anticipated a billion-dollar shortfall. I know that you don't have new money to invest this year. I know that you're working hard to stave off cuts for programs that serve the most vulnerable Minnesotans. I know that you're committed to helping people who are homeless, but the pilot was cut last year when there was new money. Unless we get $1 million restored, 60 families and 90 single adults will lose the support that's made it possible for them to break the cycle of homelessness. Without $1 million, we cannot keep the frontline staff. This means 150 households will likely become homeless again. Before the pilot, people who were homeless were incarcerated because they were mentally ill. People were put in jail because they didn't have a place to live. People had long hospital stays because they were very sick and didn't have a home to be discharged to. If we take away these services, the state will still spend the money as people return to emergency shelters, jails, prisons, emergency rooms, and hospitals. When I talk to people who have been helped by the pilot, they tell me that they thought the proposition of getting support and housing was too good to be true. But they didn't have anything to lose, so they gave it a try. They say that the pilot staff hoped and dreamed for them until they were able to hope and dream for themselves. The pilot gave hope to the hopeless, homes to the homeless, and services to help them stay there. We've all seen that the pilot worked, and it's being replicated to help hundreds more break the cycle of homelessness. Now the participants in the pilot that started it all are in jeopardy. I'm asking you to support House File 3381 and find a way to restore $1 million to the Long-Term Homeless Support and Service Fund. If you don't, I'll need to meet with these families and single adults and tell them that they were right. It was too good to be true. I'd like to introduce Jim McCree, who's been a participant in the pilot here in Ramsey County since April of 2003.
Jim, you want to use this one?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McCree.
My name is Jim McCree. I appreciate this opportunity to share my experience with Hard Connection Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot. My story of not having consistent or stable housing starts the first time I ran away from home. I was 6 years old. My stepfather physically abused me. My mom was an alcoholic and suffered from depression. Even though I knew she loved me, she didn't have it in her to protect me from her husband's abuse. And the one or two times she tried, he would lay into her and I would jump to her defense. I was bounced from institution to institution when I was young, and I would go back home in between placements, but nothing really changed. With a record of institutionalization, I was labeled as having an authority problem. I was psychologically tested and spent weeks in seclusion as a child. I was 13 the last time I was home with my family. I started experimenting with drugs when I was 7 years old, and at age 17, they gave up on institutionalizing me. As an adult, my homelessness was spent mostly outdoors, camping, and a few times in shelters. In my 20s and 30s, within a period of 8 years, I was stabbed 12 and 19 times and shot twice. It was a very violent period of my life. In 1998, I wound up at a mental health chemical dependency treatment center, and I was first diagnosed with an antisocial borderline manic depression and post-traumatic stress disorder by having a violent home and life from what I'd seen on the street. I've been with the Delancey Street team from the pilot since they started in March of 2003. I never had an apartment until I started working with them. While I had jobs off and on since age 17, I could never keep them. My mental health barriers would cause so much anxiety that I would lose my job because of absences and tardiness. I now have a psychiatrist and a nurse practitioner, and I'm on medication, so my disorder isn't as bad, and my drinking has gotten a lot better. But being in public, functioning out of my home is still really hard. I would likely have died without Delancey Street. I was on a downward spiral in my life when I met them, and I would probably have been drinking so heavily that I'd have frozen outside. I definitely wouldn't have made it this far. Delancey Street is not like any other program or anything else that's ever tried to help me. The reason I work with them is that they've never forced me to do anything. They give me suggestions and ask my opinion. We'll try different options and see how things go. They treat me and talk to me like a partner. My life has improved a lot since I've been with them. They helped me get my apartment and furniture and my two cats, Mike and Water. They helped me learn how to budget my money, get a bus card, and get to appointments. They are responsible for where I am today. I was in rough shape with my drinking and living outside when they found me. Delancey Street gave me hope, and it's genuine. They do care about what happens to me. This helps me care about myself, and it helps me with my self-determination. I want to add that bottom line is that Delancey Street isn't about rigid enforcement, they're about bottom line support. As I wrap up, I want to emphasize that it's pretty hard for me to be here in front of all of you today. I don't like to go out, and it can be hard for me to be in front of people, but I have been volunteering with Guild Incorporated to talk about my experience and to educate people quite a lot in the past year or so. I do it because I want to give back. If a few minutes of me feeling uncomfortable can help other people get housing and get services that they need, it's definitely worth it. And after this is all done, I'm very glad that I'm able to give back, and that's this feeling that makes me willing to keep doing this. Thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. You did a terrific job. Questions? Oh, wait 1 moment. Okay.
If I could, I'd like to introduce Julie Shannon. She's the mobile service team leader at the Wilder Foundation.
My name is Julie Shannon, and I'm the supervisor for Project Quest, which is part of the Wilder Foundation and began as part of the Supportive Housing and Managed Care pilot. I want to tell you about the families I work with. Some of the families became homeless when the family they created broke apart. Fathers going to prison, partners inflicting violence. Some parents lost their housing and their children at the same time to child protection. One father lived in 27 states with his young son, while another mother of six had 14 addresses in 3 years. Alcohol, meth, and crack cocaine use took some families off course and led to evictions and criminal charges. Let me tell you some other things about these families. They are incredibly resilient. They love their children dearly. They have amazing survival skills. And with the assistance of Project Quest, I can take a bit of a breather around one aspect of their life, their housing. Our goal is stable housing. When this happens, there is more energy to address the other life challenges that contributed to homelessness, to get therapy or tutoring for a child, to have the courage to leave an unhealthy relationship, to get treatment, to follow through with medication for mental illness, and to get out of bed and get treatment for depression. For a child, it means stability. To have the same bus stops for a whole year, to be able to sign up for after-school activities and to be proud of what their parents are doing, things children do. Project Quest plays a part in this by respectfully walking alongside of them in this journey, providing support, resources, connections, education, encouragement, assisting when life brings challenges that feels like it will bury them all over again. Challenges such as an emotionally disturbed son who breaks the front door, an apartment that is overflowing with clutter, relying on child support to get by and regularly going months without any income, having your apartment robbed by your own father. In each of these situations, without the services of Project Quest, these families would have been back on the street. Please support services for our families. Support House File 3381. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to the other witnesses, any questions from key members for any of the three witnesses? I did have a question for Mr. McCree. I wanted to know where Delancey Street is. I don't see it on the list here.
It's part of the Grand Incorporated. It's at the other end of the Wabatot Bridge.
St. Paul.
Right, yeah. Okay. Well, there's one on top. I think that's the main office.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may. Delancey Street is a team that works with people wherever they are in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mobile services team that supports people who predominantly live in private market apartment buildings, like where Jim lives just up on Rice Street. Mm-hmm. So it's not one place.
Okay.
It's many places throughout the community.
Okay. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I just want to thank all of our supporters who showed up today.
I'm going to ask them to stand up so we can see who they are. All right.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for coming.
Terrific. Thank you. I'm grateful. I thought the testimony was excellent. And when you described what happened last session, at the end of the session, that certainly was a very difficult time. And President Biner played an important role in trying to restore that money a little tiny bit. So we have, hopefully we'll be able to go forward. President Biner, you have three more witnesses, is that right? Or is that?
I'll ask Jennifer Ho to speak to that because she brought some people that are new to our list here. So.
Okay.
Madam Chair, there are three people tied to Trust You and New Foundations who wanted to speak in support of this bill today. And so I would turn this over to Mary Hartman, who's the executive director of the foundations, and then she's brought with her two residents of Crestview, LaDonna Lampkin and Aaron King.
Great. Welcome, and if you'll just introduce yourself to the tape, please.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartman, and I'm the founder and executive director of New Foundation. We provide housing and supportive services to homeless families in recovery. And I'm done talking now because I'd like to turn it over to two of our residents who can speak from experience about services and their importance.
Thank you.
LaDonna.
You can just introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Chair, Madam Chairperson and Committee. My name is Aaron King, and I'm a resident of the New Foundation Long-Term Supportive Housing Program.
Oh, and I'm LaDonna Lampkin. I'm also a participant of New Foundation's and Crestview Housing Program.
Welcome.
I'm supposed to go first, I guess.
Okay.
I'm a little bit nervous because anytime I come into a place like this, it's usually I'm on trial for something.
Not on trial today, okay? Very happy to have you.
I didn't come with a written agenda or anything like that, but I do want to stress how important it is for us to get some kind of financial help on that the services bill for 3381. Okay. I just want to take you on a little journey with me.
Mm-hmm.
I came here with my boyfriend, and at the time I had two children. I was pregnant with one. We were homeless when we got to Minneapolis. I don't have any family here. I've lived on the street for 10 years with my children. We were in and out of homeless shelters. I have been on drugs for many, many years of my life. So, for a while, I lived on the street supporting my children, as I would think, and being okay with being homeless. Anytime that I tried to get help for my homelessness, I would get a slap in the face. Okay, it's really hard to get in shelter. If you're not abused or anything like that, you have a problem with getting into shelters. And it's hard to save money if you're living in a shelter to get back on your feet. So we ended up going back onto the streets of Minneapolis. I lost my children due to homelessness and drug use. I went to treatment to get help for my drug abuse, only to find that there was no housing available to me. I ended up back on drugs. I stayed out that time for 5 years. I went back to treatment. This time I was fortunate enough to be placed at New Foundation Supportive Housing. I have had no contact with my children up until that point for 7 years. I now have contact with my children on a regular basis because of the support that I received at New Foundation Supportive Housing. I am an active, productive member of society today because of the support that I receive at New Foundation Supportive Housing. I am one of the faces of the women who have been homeless, on drugs, and back active in society today because of the support I received at New Foundation. I now have a place to bring my children when I am visiting with them. I can honestly say that I can look into the future and see me having my children back. A lot of women don't ever get that chance because they don't receive any support. I didn't come with a written agenda. And I thank all of you for coming here and listening today. I get help with my mental illness. I'm coming up on 9 months clean. I have never had 9 months clean off drugs. I love where I live today. I have keys to a place that I can call home. Something that I haven't had in so many years. I just want you to look at my face and know that I'm one of the people who will be back on the street if we don't receive the help that we need to keep our houses. I almost lost my housing due to some things that came up in my background. I was, because of Section 8, some stuff that came up in my background, I was this close to being homeless again. And I don't know where I would be if I didn't live at New Foundations right now. And that's all I got. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Lemke. Very helpful testimony. I really appreciate you being here.
Good morning again, Chair, Madam Chairperson and Committee. Again, my name is Aaron Keene. I also, as I said before, I'm a resident of the New Foundation Crestview Long-Term Community Housing Program. I'll take you on a journey with me as well. I'm a single parent, a 14-year-old daughter. I've had my daughter since she was 1 week old. I suffered from mental stress due to my childhood coming up. I've been homeless since I was 7 years old, in and out of places, living where and anywhere I could. I came to New Foundation in 2006. Previous to me coming to New Foundation, I lived anywhere I could. I lived in dumpsters. I've lived up under bridges, abandoned cars. I've eaten out of trash. I've been to prison 3 times. Because of suffering from homelessness. I committed crimes to put me in a place where I could have a warm bed and something to eat. I suffer today from mental stress and manic depression. Since 2006, New Foundation has given me a place to live, to raise my child. My child now today, because of my ability to be a productive person in society, I have 3 felony convictions. Because of my convictions, I was turned down numerous of times to get housing. What I'm trying to get the committee to understand is we are suffering people today because of the lack of funding. I'm not asking you guys to take away. I'm asking you to give us a chance to be productive in society. Today, I'm a graduate from St. Paul Technical College with a degree. I don't know how I got it, but I knew there was hope in me getting it. You see, because when I went to prison, it wasn't by choice. It was by force. Today, my child is an A-plus honor roll student at Highland Park at Senior High School. I get all the support I need. I have an educational program where I live. I have counseling where I live. I have a support team that gets behind us and help us. I'm also a mentor in our program for our youths. I've traveled throughout the metro area speaking to youth at all types of high schools about homelessness and drug addiction. I was a drug addict for 20 years. My drug addiction led to me being depressed because I had no place to go. My parents were not my parents. They gave me life, but they didn't give me structure. Because of this lady here, I found a new way of living. I live in a very successful program. I'm asking you as chairperson and committee, support this bill, because this bill saved not only my life, it'll save millions of others. We need you all to support us on this. I came a long ways, and I am grateful by the grace of God and mercy to be able to stand before you and testify how important this bill is. We ask you today, as homeless people that live in supportive long-term houses, support this bill, because this bill will not only continue to help me, it will help my child and many other families like us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. King. Any questions or comments from committee members, any of the witnesses? I guess we do have one more testifier. Sue Watlove Phillips. While you're seated, let me just welcome the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. They're participating in the Minnesota Historical Society's Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government. Welcome to the Committee on Public Health and Housing. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, committee, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm Executive Director of the Elam Transitional Housing. We serve about 6,000 people a year in the metro area that are at risk of experiencing homelessness through a variety of programs, including outreach, screening all families in Hampton County shelters, rapid rehousing, transitional housing, permanent housing, long-term homeless subsidies. And I've personally worked with people experiencing homelessness for over 34 years. Also president and owner of Integrated Community Solutions, that's working on integrating and coordination of homeless programs on the federal, state, local, and level, including state legislation, and past president of the National Coalition for the Homeless. I want to thank this committee and the state legislature for being a model for the rest of the country in really being innovative and creating different funding services to assist in preventing people from becoming homeless all the way through the continuum of housing and including this bill that provides supportive services to folks. I do have some concerns about the long-term homeless program generally and specifically around this program. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Many of these issues that I'm going to talk about, I have talked with state agencies. I've commented on the governor's long-term plan to end homelessness, as well as the recalibration of that plan, as well as worked with Senator Marty in sending a letter to the interagency on homelessness on with these concerns. Nationally, and here in Minnesota, there's been a strong focus on chronic or long-term homeless over the past few years to assist those people experiencing homelessness that are on the streets and have long histories of homelessness. You've met several of them today, Aaron, Madonna, and Jim. They became homeless or unable to get housing because we destroyed their housing, we did not create new housing, and we did not provide the services to assist them. They need and deserve our help. And I encourage you to fund this program this year to make sure that none of the folks that are presently in the pilot program become homeless. Unfortunately, though, there are some things that have happened within the long-term homeless programs that does not allow us to use those dollars in an efficient manner. And that's what I want to talk about. These are things that are happening within state agencies that do not allow us to utilize those dollars in the most effective way. One is that programs are given mixed messages from state agencies whether we can expect participants to pay rent, abide by landlord-tenant law, apply for subsidized housing or other means and services to address their issues so that they can increase their income through employment and other assistance and move into other types of subsidized housing. In addition to that, we are not able to move participants between different long-term homeless programs, and that means that many folks are in programs that they don't need to be in and not maybe in the most cost-effective program for them. What you have in front of you is what we have to fill out under long-term homeless for the Homeless Management Information System. For an individual, it's 120 items, and then if you're a family, it's more than that, that goes into an internet system, which has not provided reliable data, and we have some data privacy violations on this. That costs us an incredible amount of money as providers to do this, which we are not reimbursed for, or we have to use direct service dollars reallocated to pay for HMIS costs. All state-funded homeless programs are required to participate in the HMIS system. Basically, with the funding that you've provided through the supportive services, programs for long-term homeless, as well as other long-term homeless programs, We are almost at capacity right now. And there is limited movement between this program and opening up space for new folks to come into the program. Yet we know from the Wilder survey that we've had an increase in long-term homeless since from 2003 to 2006. That doesn't account all the folks that we have gotten into the long-term homeless permanent housing programs, subsidies, and into these programs that are in permanent housing now. So we have this growth of folks that are experiencing long-term homelessness, but we're not assisting folks that are utilizing the long-term homeless program, or at least we're not giving clear messages to programs across agencies to assist those folks to apply for subsidized housing, other types of things. Now, a lot of folks do, and there are folks that do move in to other types of permanent housing. But this is an issue that, as a committee, folks are going to come back again next year, and they're going to say, we need the same amount of money to keep doing what we're doing right now with the folks that we're serving right now. But we have more folks that are coming into long-term homeless because we're not doing enough prevention, enough money in shelter, and in transitional housing to keep people out of moving into long-term homeless. So to just complete my comments, obviously state agencies have prioritized long-term homeless services and housing programs. And the rules are a little bit different administratively for those programs than they are for the other homeless programs, which we also would like to see addressed. One of the things that I'd like to have you keep with you on this, and I hear this over and get over again as we work with long-term homeless through our programs and as we meet with folks across the community, is folks that are sitting at shelter saying, I won't meet the definition of chronic homeless on the federal level or long-term homeless on the state level for another 3 months. I'm not chronic enough. I have not been homeless enough to get into one of these programs. That's a terrible way for anybody that's experiencing homelessness to look at our system. We need a seamless system that prevents people from becoming homeless, a continuum to housing. Obviously, we need long-term homeless assistance for folks that have been on the street for long periods of time or had multiple episodes of homelessness, but we need to have the mainstream housing and services both on the state level and on the federal level so folks can move beyond these programs. Now, the issue around HMIS and about the coordination on state agencies, Representative Lane has introduced two bills on both of those that I hope the committee will take a look at before the end of this session. But I think the main thing is, one, we need to keep people in the housing that they're in and with the services that they have. And I think that we need to move ahead with the money this year. I think the challenge will be is how do we make the money that we're putting into all homeless programs as efficient and as effective as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lila Phillips. Are there questions or comments from committee members? Go ahead, Representative.
Or is that a prayer? I'm praying, not Benson. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. It strikes me as we hear all these stories, and maybe my question is maybe for Ms. Hull or even maybe through Representative Breinert, but I think we in this committee have some really difficult decisions to make based in light of our financial state. And I think oftentimes we focus a lot on the cost of doing something. And I think, Ms. Hull, you said that if we don't get this $1 million this time, maybe 60 families, or I mean, there was a number that you threw out, and I'm not sure if I caught it, but that maybe is neither here nor there. But I'm curious of what the cost of inaction is. So if somebody, and you may not have that off the top of your head, and I know it's hard to try to give realistic numbers because situations may differ, but I mean, I guess I'm looking for a reasonable estimate of what the cost of inaction related to this bill is. And I may have this question for all the bills that come to this committee, because I have a feeling when we start putting this thing together based on whatever our target is, we may have to look at the cost of inaction versus the cost of actually doing some of these programs or continuing these programs. So if you have that today, great. If you don't, get it through by the end of the week. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Krantz, we have been working hard to try to quantify exactly what you say, what's the cost of inaction. One of the things that's the most difficult about putting a price tag on homelessness is that we know that people are involved in so many different systems, and the way that our state data systems are set up, they're all very fragmented and siloed. They don't allow us to kind of say what was happening in Jim's life across all of these systems or somebody else. What I do know is that we work with people in our program. I can think of one gentleman who was arrested 85 times, who had 7 felony convictions, who served 2 of those out down in St. Peter in the ward for the mentally ill and dangerous. We have people who are in our program who have been to detox hundreds and hundreds of times, mainly because they needed a warm place to sleep. We have inefficient use of our school districts when kids don't start and end the school year in the same place. There are just so many places where our system bears the cost when people don't have a safe and stable place to live. There's a study done in New York City of about 5,000 people who had psychiatric illnesses who were also homeless. And they documented that it costs over $40,000 a year for the city of New York and New York State for these people to remain homeless. They were spending $40,000 a year on no outcome. It just seems that we can do so much better than that. And the investments that we make are more prudent. They have a much longer view of what's possible. And just the simple outcomes and the opportunities that we're giving to the 150 children in our program who are a part of 60 families and 90 single adults. So I appreciate your point, and it's difficult to document, but I think that we know from the stories and experiences of participants that government was spending a lot on zero outcome before. And now, through this work and the work of many other supportive housing programs, at least where you're investing, you're getting great outcomes.
Madam Chair, Representative Krantz, I think your question goes to the heart of the matter, not only on this bill, but on a whole range of social service programs. And I would venture to say that positive prevention is always a better investment than at-risk treatment. But we as legislators and citizens come into these issues at different points in need, and I think we're always making very complicated decisions about where is the best place to invest at the moment. You know, obviously, if there's hemorrhaging, we want to stop the bleeding, but then we want to think about the condition that led to that hemorrhaging. And so I think your question is very well taken, but the answer isn't simple.
Madam Chair, if I could respond also, Representative, because I just came out of an emergency meeting with Hennepin County in regards to us blowing out the family shelters starting in the next couple of weeks. What it would cost for each individual that's in the program right now is at least $1,000 a month in shelter. In families, it's about $3,000 to $4,000 per month. Quickly moves that number very quickly to the $1 million in a very short period of time that we would be funding through some type of shelter, whether it be through emergency general assistance, emergency assistance, or the shelter dollars that Representative Blaine will be bringing forward in just a few minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to all the testifiers, I didn't presume that this would be an easy task. And I think we have a tough task here too, but I would actually like to see some of the numbers that you said, and I'll actually go back and listen to the tape, but I would like to see it in front of me. I'm kind of a numbers guy, even though I teach social studies. I do like to see the numbers, and I think literally we're going to get down to pennies in this committee on where they go, and so I want some of that statistics and that data when we start putting this thing together. So I would appreciate getting correspondence from either Representative Brynard or any of the following people who testified. I want to know what this costs if we don't do this. And statistics and generalities are fine. I just want to get my arms around this problem. Thank you.
I think the slide that you had on the PowerPoint that had it compared emergency room detox, so on. I think your program was like $12 as compared to $12 as compared to emergency room is $246 and state hospital $447. Where's the shelter in there? Okay, the shelter would have been how much? Is that you said $1,000?
Madam Chair, she says that it's $1,000 minimally a month, and these are per day costs. But that we can do this math, can't we? That's $20 to $30 a day for somebody to be in shelter.
So we're still talking about half of the price, at least, or less, for the pilot service. I think it's really helpful. Can you make that PowerPoint available, or at least that slide?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to make both the PowerPoint and the testimony available. Okay. That way you don't have to listen to the tape again.
Okay. If there's no other...
This graph is also in the handout that the committee received.
Okay, does it get...
It's on the bottom right-hand corner of the bridge.
Oh, okay. I do have another question about this HMIS form. And I think, obviously at the top of the first page, it says MHFA program funds. I think you indicated that other agencies as well are requiring this.
Madam Chair, all the state agencies are requiring that all state homeless programs participate in HMIS. The number of data elements vary by the program, so for each of the different programs, we may have to fill out additional forms. What HUD is asking for from states and continuum of care, that's how we receive the federal dollars, is that communities participate in doing the 14 data elements, the universal data element form. That would continue to allow us to score high in our continuum of cares so that we would continue to receive the $20 million or so that we receive from HUD each year for homeless programs. So, you know, obviously we want to continue to do that. Obviously, there's some concerns about data privacy as well as the number of data elements that we're putting into an internet system and whether it's really necessary for us to collect this level of information and be putting it into a system that has had significant difficulties over the last several years.
And is this concern one that's shared, and maybe I should ask Ms. Hull and others, is this a concern that's shared across all of the various providers, service providers, whether we're talking about long-term transitional shelters? Is this a common concern that we're hearing in regard to this particular document?
Madam Chair, there are significant concerns across the state with varying providers. Certainly the providers such as Elam, Catholic Charities, and other groups that are very large providers that have multiple state and federal and local funding sources, it's very difficult to do this. It costs Elam $50,000 a year to do this. We do not consider the data reliable. It's primarily private dollars from family foundations, primarily Republican families that are giving us that money that we basically think we're throwing away.
Ms. Hull, do you want to share a comment on that issue of this particular documentation by any chance with your organization? And if not, that's fine. I just want to know if you do.
Madam Chair, I can tell you two things. The implementation of the Homeless Management Information System has been a complicated one, and it has put providers through a lot of burden and difficulty. We have the advantage with the programs that we operate of having our own information management system, which some folks even like. that simplifies today's question process and allows us to simply upload to HMIS. So we don't have the same challenges that other programs have, but we're still able to collect the data. And Heart Connection is in the data. We believe that it's really important to be able to know who we serve, how we're doing, and to be able to use that type of information to both help contribute to public policy making, but also to constantly be looking at provider quality and opportunities for participants. So I guess what I would say is that we need to have good data systems. I think the question of what's a good system and what's not a good system is perhaps the one that's important.
Well, thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony. Oh, Representative Anderson, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The materials that you have here for filling out and collecting information, do you do that once for an individual and then that's on file and you don't have to do this again? Or is it, do you have to update this? Is there a certain criteria of timeline that the department only says you have to fill it out again? Or what's the criteria for...
Madam Chair, Representative, it's varying levels. Because we have done very well here in Minnesota in creating a variety of homeless prevention and shelter and transitional housing and different programs. Basically what happens is that people may have to fill this out multiple times as they move through programs. So for example, we do all the screening of all the families at Hennepin County shelters. So we have to fill this out on everybody. That goes into the Hennepin County system. Then folks may move to a rapid exit, which may be our program, may be a different program. Now, if that information is shared, then we may be able to move some of that information forward. We can't get back to the original information, but that information moves forward on the family, accurate or not accurate, as the case may be. Then as folks move into transitional housing or into one of these programs, depending upon if that information is shared or not, they may have to refill that out again. So folks may fill out HMIS multiple times as they are moving through the system trying to get into permanent housing.
To that point, if the information is the same as far as who the person is and their age, their height, and, you know, da-da-da, so forth and so on, I don't understand why the department is making you do this multiple times, because you should be able to transfer within the state information from Minneapolis to St. Paul to Bloomington to Robbinsdale, wherever you're going to go. I don't understand where you're going to come into a new situation, but I would think it would be just a matter of updating it rather than refilling the whole thing out.
Madam Chair and Representative, in an ideal situation, where we could move that information along in that way, we have programs that lock down the information, do not have releases to share that with other agencies if folks are moving through that. Folks have that right to determine as a participant in a program if they want that information shared with other agencies. So what we have is a situation where obviously, you know, you've identified many of the concerns that many of us as providers, as folks move through various systems, as we try to stabilize them in the community, in housing, in mainstream services, that this is one area that we are spending an incredible amount of time, staff time, and what used to be direct service dollars is going into putting information into a system that does not move with folks through the system and then does not allow us to go back and then account for the funding that we've spent on in each of those programs along the way. So the information changes as folks move through the program. So I can't get back to where people started and look at information there, because when they're in our permanent supportive housing, they're no longer considered homeless because they've moved out of the shelter.
Okay, this may be a subject for more discussion. I want to thank Representative Reiner and all the witnesses who came today. We do have two more bills. I appreciate it. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in under this bill. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Benson, and we will try to move along. Welcome to your committee, Representative Benson. If you could have your witnesses come up and join you right there. There we go.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate very much your hearing this bill this morning. And if you wish, I would move House File 1233 for possible inclusion.
Representative Benson moves House File 1233 for possible inclusion in honor of the bill from this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm kind of easy because I am carrying a chief author 26 bills having to do with education, affordable housing, this bill, and many others, crime prevention. So, but I feel this is the most important bill I'm carrying. And the reason I feel that way is this is the most essential need. It is the absolutely most essential need any human being can have. We are dealing here with an issue of basic human rights, the right to nutrition. And I'm aware, as everyone in this committee is, that the state is facing a budgetary shortfall. I also know that the state does have some reserves in what we call rainy day fund. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in a rainy day. Economically. And so I'm hoping that the committee will look at this proposal in a different light than we do any other proposals we have. I think sufficient nutrition for every human being is the most essential issue, and it really sets it apart from all other considerations that this state faces each biennium. And we're facing a particular difficulty this time around because of the recession, because of a 45% increase in need, which will be discussed by our two presenters here today. And I'm also hopeful that those members of this committee, on whichever side of the aisle they're on, look at this issue as not a Republican or Democratic issue, but a human rights issue. And that those who have the ear of the governor, for example, or the agencies at the state level who would deal with this issue, would consider making this a high priority. I'm not sure whether there is anything in the budget that the governor has submitted having to do with food shelves and food support, but I would strongly urge those who may have some influence with the executive branch to support this initiative. The initiative is very simple. It is only a partial page, and we're asking for a funding increase of $1,150,200. And that number comes from the fact that there is a growing demand and need for this intervention. So with that brief introduction, I would like to introduce two presenters, Colleen Moriarty, who is the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota, and Michelle Regas, Executive Director of Friends in Need of Food Shelves, who serves St. Louis Park, Newport, Cottage Grove, and Great Cloud Island.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Representative Benson, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Moriarty. I'm the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. We're a comprehensive statewide hunger organization. I've been in front of this committee before. I've been warmly greeted by those of you. Last year, when I came to talk about the fact that there had been a continuing increase in those in need in our communities visiting food shelves. In fact, since 2000, a 60% increase in the visits to food shelves. Last year alone, in 2007, in the 300 food shelves in the state of Minnesota, we had 1.9 million visits, and they distributed 47 million pounds of food. And yet, there has never been an increase in this funding since it was established in 1995. Now, the budgets of food shelves around the state of Minnesota are made up of many different sources. Part of it is your generous support and the state support of food shelves. A lot of it is community stepping forward to support people within their own communities. Much of it is faith communities that have come forward, but frankly, they just can't keep up with the demand. These are the working families in our community who are trying to cobble together enough to be able to make it through the month. And what once started out as an emergency system is now the way that the same people are visiting the food shelves, saying, we have no flexibility in how much we're going to spend for rent. Our transportation costs have gone up. Our health care costs are skyrocketing. And yet, our money for food is shrinking, and we can't make it through the month without visiting the food shelf. Food has become a luxury for many people in the state of Minnesota, and that's something we just can't afford. I'm well aware of the fact that we face tough economic times, and that you face difficult decisions as you move forward. But our families in our state face a difficult decision every day. How they're going to feed their children, how they're going to, seniors who are going to be able to make it through the month. Those are the people that visit food shelves. Those are the people that depend on this funding. And those are the people that we need to step forward and support as you did last year. Unfortunately, the governor vetoed the bill and we did not receive an increase. But we just can't afford not to support the families in our community. We just can't afford for people to wonder from day to day whether or not they're going to have enough food to make it through the day. 35 million Americans in this country are food insecure. 300,000 of those are Minnesotans. Those are the people that depend on us, and we depend on you to support us. As part of our efforts at Hunger Solutions Minnesota within the last year, we've been working to make sure that the quality a service that is represented in those 300 food shelves around the state of Minnesota rises to the level to meet the needs. and we developed something called the Blue Ribbon Food Shelf Initiative. It has been welcomed and embraced by the 300 food shelves in the state of Minnesota. It's a rigorous tool that's used by them. We use the Charities Review Council in helping to develop the Blue Ribbon Food Shelf Initiative. And it's our first Blue Ribbon Food Shelf is in Cottage Grove, and the director of that food shelf is here today to talk about the increase that she's seen and what we've done to make sure that the quality of service throughout the state of Minnesota is maintained so that people in our state are being treated with respect and dignity. And I'd like to introduce Michelle Raggett, and she is, her food shelf is the first recipient of the Blue Ribbon Food Shelf Initiative in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chair, members.
Welcome to the committee.
Members. I was asked here just to kind of give the on-the-ground view of what happens at the local food shelf on a local level. I've been the director at Friends and Me Food Shelf for 10 years. When I started, it was around 3,000 people we served a year. This last year, we served 13,000 people. The need is out there. We have several different categories of people that we are seeing, and that dynamic is changing as the time goes by. You always have the elderly and you have the disabled, and they're going to need our help always. Their situation isn't going to change. They're on a fixed income. You have the working poor, and that makes up a large part of who we serve. They're working as hard as they can, but they're not making enough to be able to pay for the rent, for the transportation, for the utilities, and for food. And so they need our help, and they probably will need it on a long-term basis. But what we're seeing in the last few years are more middle-class families, families that supported us for years and years, and now we're finding that they need us. We're seeing a lot of that. And they come into a food shelf, and sometimes they're teary-eyed because they're a little embarrassed at being there. They say, I've been giving to all of your drives for years, and I never thought I'd have to be here. And a lot of times, by the time they leave, they're in tears with gratitude because they're overwhelmed. Someone has some answers for them, and someone's making sure that their children are fed. I'm working with so many families, and I just chose one to talk about for a moment. A very middle-class family, two incomes, long-term jobs, doing very well. Within 2 months, both of them were laid off, and they had a baby that had huge medical issues at birth. $300,000 in medical bills. You know, they came into the food shelf in total shock. These are middle-class people who never had to worry about where their next meal was coming from. And we were able to refer them to the medical assistance programs, which helped with the medical bills. We were able to give them job lists, which we create every week to try to help with local employment. And most of all, we were able to say, you come back as much as you need to so that you don't have to worry about the food. And these are the people that could be any one of us. All of us are just a few paychecks away from being in this situation. So I just wanted to put a face to what we're dealing with in the local level. And yes, we have wonderful community support. We have wonderful volunteers, but we also need the funding that we're applying for now. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm ready to answer any of your questions, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Any comments or questions, committee members? I do have one. Oh, Representative Eastland.
Madam Chair, and this is more of a comment than anything else. I think clearly just the economic times are having a significant effect on the usage. And it appears the usage is going up. I think we could discuss that issue for a long time. But I guess, have we looked at places that we could actually get food resources to be able to use? I know that there are how our food chain works in this country. I mean, there are bread companies that run around all over that have day-old bread. I mean, there's truckloads of the stuff. There's produce that it doesn't get used in store. Do we have mechanisms in place to be able to capture some of that stuff? Because there's a lot of it we're not capturing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, in fact, we work with the American Second Harvest Blue Banks, of which there are six: Cookston, Duluth, Grand Rapids, Rochester, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Fargo. And included in their program is food recovery organizations. In the local area, it's out of Second Harvest Heartland. There also is one through the Emergency Food Service Network, which works with restaurants in picking up food that can be distributed not only to food shelves, but to shelters and to other programs who have a daily meal, community meal program, so that they can redistribute the food. And they're also, they have are constantly looking for new donors to redistribute to the food shelves and other programs. But, and you're right, any opportunities that we have to point those programs in the right direction or to do everything we can to hook them up and make sure that that resource is used, we will do. The fact of the matter is, though, there is less and less of what we used to depend on in the emergency food system as surplus product available now. For one thing, we've gotten much better at not mislabeling materials boxes, which, when there was a bad run, flats of those things used to go into the food bank so that they could be redistributed if something didn't quite turn out right. The production has gotten much more efficient. And then secondly, after 9/11, there was an advent of a whole new marketplace, and that was this. Much of the product that used to be, that go to food banks, is now available in the dollar stores. And the dollar stores were really created to create a cash flow for corporations in a way that they used to donate those products to be redistributed. They now sell them on the marketplace. Now, it's difficult to argue against the dollar store because many poor people in communities use the dollar stores and take advantage of it. But it greatly diminished the amount of product that was available. And so you'll see that has had an impact. The other thing is that I want you to be aware of the fact that we're making every attempt to make sure that the product that we're getting to redistribute to the food banks and the food shelf is, has a high nutritional quality, because that's very important. People who don't have access to, live in food deserts, don't have access to the kind of fresh fruit and produce and other kinds of high-protein foods, we're making every effort we can to provide balanced food to people so that they have an opportunity to experience what we experience on a daily level. And there is waste in every economy. There's waste in our economy. And we try to do everything we can to combat that. As I said, we have regular food recovery units that go out and capture it. And we work with grocers and others to make sure that there are not only an opportunity to donate at the local retail, but an opportunity to recapture food that isn't used.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the efforts. I guess my question is legislatively, have we ever looked at how to incentivize this? Because it costs money.
Right.
It costs money for the retailers to try to figure out how to get this stuff out so it can be used in the. But I mean, there is tons of food, tons. When you look at the retailers, the grocery retailers, we look at the Cubs, the Rainbows, the Walmarts, and you look at Country Hearth Bakeries, you look at the Master Bread, and you look at, I mean, there are truckloads of things that are destroyed
mm-hmm.
every week. And isn't there some way that we can incentivize those companies so it's more than a donation? It's a donation, but that doesn't really mean anything on their bottom line. If it costs money to make the donation, it's difficult for a business person that's dealing with large corporate industry to be able to say, well, we're gonna do this when it's just way more hassle and time than it takes. If there were some ways we could incentivize that, but from our standpoint here in government, it seems like that would be a starting point to at least begin to kind of pave the way so that surplus food isn't just viewed as an unnecessary, unwanted commodity, but it's something that actually has some value to somebody if you handle it right and you do it right. So we could create this mechanism. I mean, I think, you know, giving more money is an approach, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the issue. We have tons of food going to waste, and this isn't going to change that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a more fundamental issue we should be talking about here.
Representative Marietti.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I said, there are food recovery programs at the food banks who do work with, in particular, Rainbow and Cobb and some of the other vendors that you're talking about, where they take the surplus food and then they redistribute it. And I think most recently, in fact, just last week, Ramsey and Washington counties themselves established new agreements with the food banks about food recovery. I don't know if Hennepin has completed that, but I know the food banks are looking at local counties to contact vendors to do that. Certainly, the surplus food in restaurants is another area that I think that we need to look at to make sure that we're doing the kind of recovery of restaurant food that we can redistribute through shelters and other programs. So there's always more ground to plow. Whether or not we've legislatively looked at incentivizing that kind of program, I think has been done, not maybe on a state level, but on a county level. But I could check into that information and get that to you.
Thank you very much. Unless there's any other questions, we'd probably... Oh, Representative Trumper? Representative Moe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, Ms. Murray, I want to thank you for your work. In particular, in my district, the Bemidji Food Shelf and the Catholic Family Center provide food for many families, and it's pretty much all they get. I mean, believe it or not, there, as you know, there are subsistence families still in northern Minnesota, and you provide them with them and their families some need of nutrition. And just to Representative Eastland's point, it's amazing all of the things that actually show up there. Many of us who are gardeners bring our things that we can't eat ourselves to a food shelf that's organized. The venison donation program that was somewhat controversial, but now that's really provided a meat source for the food shelf statewide, but in particular where I live. And we can always do more, but it's remarkable how resourceful they are now, finding as many avenues to get food to those shelves as possible. But as you know, they're open less, and they have less food now on the shelves than they used to, regardless of how creative they've had to be for the reasons that you've outlined here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Moe. That's absolutely true. And to your point, sir, when you were making the observation of what the cost of not doing, of not meeting a need would be, as I was sitting in the gallery waiting for my opportunity to speak with you, the fact of the matter is that the cost per the allocation would probably go down because there would be fewer hours. In fact, at Keystone Community Services, they've already curtailed the hours. They've closed 2 days a week because they simply don't have enough to meet the need. So they're already, after this pent-up need for so many years, there already is fewer opportunities, and people get less food when they're able to go to the food shelf. The poundage goes down. And so I think what we have is the return to long lines at meal programs and soup kitchens in our community, like we've seen before in history, a sad testimony to the fact of that this kind of nutrition service is something that we believe in as a community, and we believe in as a state and a country. But we don't want to return to the soup kitchen era. We want to make sure that people have enough food to be able to feed themselves and their families while they're working. These are people who are contributing to our state's economy, and they need to be greeted as the citizenry that they are. They are us. We're no strangers.
Madam Chair, just one more comment. The Poverty Commission toured the state, and they, when we were in Bemidji, they asked that we not go to the food shelf on the morning that we were there because of the line, because the families that were coming would have been somewhat embarrassed or not wanting the publicity, but the line goes down the street on the mornings in which the food shelf is open in Bemidji. And so we see it there in town, right in town.
The food, members of the committee, the food shelf community throughout the state of Minnesota has worked with the Poverty Commission to make sure that as you've visited different communities, you've heard the story, and I think as a representative on that committee, you can give testimony to that about how hunger affects all parts of the state. In Carver County, since 2005 to 2006, a 26% increase. In Scott County, a 23% increase. In Dakota County, a 13% increase. This is 1 year. This is a dramatic increase in the amount of people who are needing assistance. And the allocation from the state, as generous it is part of the picture, but it's a very important part of the picture. Thank you.
Representative Shumpert, and then we'll...
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, more of a comment, I guess. Somewhat of a different take on Representative Eastland's comments about what we could do as a legislature or as government. It seems to me we already have, and that is a lot of people are attributing a lot of the dramatic increase in food costs that we've seen the last couple of years to our ethanol expansion, our increased production of ethanol, and that's a direct result of pretty heavy subsidies on both the federal and state level. So I think, you know, that's kind of one of these unintended consequences, it seems to me, that we're seeing some pretty dramatic increases. And I'm wondering if any of the people who come into your food shelves talk about that, if that's part of the reason they're coming there, just because food prices have gone up so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. The rising food costs in the state of Minnesota and this country has been dramatic. I just returned last night from Washington working on the farm bill, trying to, you know, to once again urge some kind of movement on the federal level, because after all, 60% of that farm bill is for food support for the citizens in our community who are in greatest need. And so I think that, you know, subsidies to create new energy sources and conservation efforts are important. But in this country, we've made a commitment to serve people in the land of the richest agricultural culture in the world. And yet 60% of the farm bill is geared towards the poorest of the poor. And we can't seem to get it moving. I'm hoping that we see some progress, and I'm hoping that the president decides not to veto the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And this bill will also be laid over for passing in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Lane. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 758.
Representative Lane moves House File 758 for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is to reinitiate the funding proposal that we had last year in the omnibus bill, $6 million for transitional housing, of which we had $750,000 that got funded, and $3.25 million for emergency services, of which $600,000 got funded. So I'd like to reinitiate this proposal, keep it before us, and to keep it active and in our awareness. You know, the first line of defense is to prevent the need for any of these services, so that's an economic and cultural problem. This one is part of the second line of defense, early intervention. The people who come in for these services are in crisis, and they try to manage their situation. And the majority of them are children. They are able then to take care of the needs of food, shower, clothing, and shelter, and then they're able to attend to the business of issues related to their homelessness. So when families stabilize and address these needs, they can not only find permanent housing, but they can actually keep it. So transitional housing and emergency services then help our families move from no home through a transitional home and to a new home. So, Michael Bell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and you probably...
Welcome.
I've been fidgeting up in the chair there, because you probably all know that I'm kind of a guy of hope, but I'm also kind of angry. And I have to tell you that this is an insanity of our own creation. To fund shelter or long-term homelessness services, why is the word or in that question? To fund food for people this month, for transitional housing, that's a ridiculous question. In the mid-80s, we had maybe 1,000 people that were in shelters and a couple hundred people turned away. Now we have 7,000 people in shelters and 1,000 turned away. I can tell you, there haven't been 6,000 people who woke up and said, I think I'd like to flee from the abuse that I'm dealing with in my home, and that's what's going to make my homelessness. It's been that there's been a different response to people in crisis, and we need this committee to please address the crisis head on right now. It's as bad as it's ever been. We need the preventative stuff that deals with how do we address violence, how do we get affordable housing, how do we get services to people who fall into crisis, and that is also the work of this committee. But what do you do to people once they fall into crisis? And I'm going to make this sort of personal sort of story that really talk about all of the parts of what you need. And this committee needs to walk to the governor's office and to your leadership on both sides of the aisle and demand more money to deal with this problem. You heard from Jim McCree. Jim McCree was helped through outreach and long-term homeless services. We need both outreach and long-term homeless services, and you heard why his story is just so amazing, and we needed to give him help. We also need emergency shelter. You know, I told some of you the story a while back that when I volunteered 17 years ago at the Fort Kent shelter, my job was to mentor kids. They didn't have a lot of homework, so I just played games with them. And this kid, the Clev, beat me a Connect Four every week. And they would have me play Clev all the time because he could beat me. I don't like kids that much, so I wasn't going to let him beat me, but he beat me. And he only needed help, and his family only needed help for less than a month. So we needed shelter to be there to help the Clev and his family make it through. Another story, and this really gets personal, is that there was a time probably about 7 years ago where I was leading this committee and I had successfully gotten some money, I think, to the Family Homeless Prevention Program. And I got a call on my cell phone when a cell phone was probably six times this size. And people didn't have cell phone numbers because people didn't have cell phones. So I'm like, why am I getting a call on my cell phone? If someone very close to me said, Michael, I need help now, not for me, but for someone that you know, and I'm not going to tell you who it is, but I called Sue, and I said, please don't let this person I know be one of the 1,000 people you turn away tonight. And that person was helped. Someone was turned away because that person was helped. There were requests for $24 million worth of requests for $10,000 worth of resources that he provided to shelters and transitional housing. $14 million worth of turnaways. You know, I want to end and then turn it over to Sue. Is that I have a picture and we're going to just pass it out to the committee. A little over a month ago. Someone was discovered outside the Catholic Diocese in Fargo. This is Vernon. Jim said he was afraid that he would have frozen to death if long-term homeless services weren't available to him. Vernon did die outside of Catholic Charities, or the Catholic Diocese, a place that he used to get help. It fell 14 degrees below zero, and there wasn't shelter to help him. I'm being honest here. I would love for you to write that letter that you talked about last week, Representative Clark. Representative Peterson, you said, what can we do to keep this thing going? And I would love for you to write a letter on the back of this picture and get it to leadership and to the governor. I don't care what party, and say, we can't have this continue. And you have the power to change that. You do. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
Sue Watlow Phillips, I'm Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing. Given a brief explanation of the different services that we have, and you have a brochure on Elam Transitional Housing. When I began working with people experiencing homelessness in 1974, we did not have this number of people experiencing homelessness. We had some youth shelters, some youth that ran away from homes. We had some missions. And we had basically Salvation Army. That's all we had, and that's all we really needed. But as we started demolishing housing with our urban renewal, if we had farm foreclosures, the changes in our mines and in our different industries across our country and across the nation, we saw more and more people at risk. Initially single people in the early 80s, then when we made a change in 1986 that took the for-profits, out of creating affordable housing because we took away the tax incentive to do rental housing for people with very limited incomes, we saw this incredible increase in families. Now, in 1984, we passed the first bill here in this committee for transitional housing, model for state legislation. We have been a model for this country on our prevention programs, on our transitional housing, on our rapid exit programs, getting people out of shelter, back into housing, as well as our long-term supportive housing programs. The issue really is that we will continue to have all these feeders coming in to a system that's supposed to be preventive and emergency. We cannot be expected to have shelters in our prevention programs, in our transitional housing programs, in our long-term homeless programs and supportive services and outreach programs to solve the mainstream housing and mainstream services programs that we have in this country and in this state. But we are. And we need to begin to really look at this in a holistic, integrated process. That yes, we do need outreach, prevention, shelter, transitional housing, other programs that we've talked about. But we need permanent affordable housing, and we need the mainstream services working so that people don't have to become homeless when they can't make it, when they can't afford to make the decision between paying for food, for health care, or paying their rent. The mortgage foreclosure is a key ingredient to increase the number of people experiencing homelessness. We see 10 to 12 new families in the rental investment property that's being foreclosed on in our communities in Tampa County right now every month. As you heard earlier, if we don't fund the long-term homeless pilot program, program we're looking at 90 plus another 60 folks that will potentially be at risk of homelessness. These are difficult decisions for you all to make. We need to make sure that we're using our dollars as efficiently as possible, but clearly, without the additional resources for shelter and transitional housing, we will have more people die on our streets in Minnesota. We usually have about 100 folks that die from homelessness each year. So I encourage you, as you struggle with these decisions, that these are life and death decisions that you are making in regards to the emergency services, transitional housing, long-term homeless, food issues for folks within our community. And you're going to have many, many issues that come before this committee, very, very worthwhile issues. Clearly, we need to increase the dollars that we have available to address the different needs that we're experiencing, but at the same time, address the mainstream programs. The one thing I just want to just put on the radar screen for you, I've been talking with Congressman Ellison, I was in D.C. last week, and working on trying to develop a pilot program here in Minnesota, so that on rental investment foreclosed property, that we will work with the lenders to actually lease those for $1 a year, and the financial institution will maintain the ownership of that property, so we can keep tenants in those properties so they don't end up in our shelter system. You give us the flexibility and the resources to be able to think creatively. We can help deal with some of these situations. But if we continue to get bound up with HMIS and other ways that we have to spend a whole lot of our direct service dollars to deal with issues, we cannot use our flexible private dollars to come up with new solutions to keep people in their housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from committee members? I just wanted to say one thing. We actually do have a draft of the letter that we were you were referencing earlier, and I think this would be a very good place to probably put it on the back of. I just and Representative Lane, thank you for bringing this bill before us. I appreciate it. I think it's really important, and I think, you know, in addition to the leadership we have here in the House and the Senate, you know, I hope the same kind of pressure is being brought over to the governor's office, because obviously we can be creative and you can be creative, and if there's not enough dollars and there's no way to raise the revenues, as you said, that we needed, then, you know, we're just stuck. So I don't look forward to some of the decisions this committee is going to have to make. We haven't received any targets yet. The governor will make his announcement, I think, on Friday, and I think I would just give back to you the same challenges before Friday. Get over there with as many people as you can, too. After that, our job is probably going to be a lot harder. But I think it's fair that we all should have to try to deal with this. And Representative Lane, I hope we're going to be able to put some funding into
Crystal.
Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
And, we have some minutes before us. Representative Anderson, could you move those minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson moves approval of the minutes of March 4th. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. So members, I think our next meeting is next Tuesday. We'll have some more information by then on our own financial status. Meeting is adjourned.